Hi, Peter Williams here. Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email or hit the join email button on your RCR app. With your help, we can continue to stand up for free speech, for open debate and rational discussion, reaching new audiences and bringing important information free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate to make a difference.
Kim Staton is a filmmaker, poet, and musician from Northern Rivers, New South Wales, Australia. He is the writer and director of The Trust Fall, Julian Assange, and the founder and director of Films for Change. He won an award for Best Emerging Director Australia at the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival last year. In 2021, Kim put himself finally behind a camera and a pen and lends his highly trained eye for subject, interpretation and narrative to direct his first documentary. It's an ambitious project. The Trust Fall includes 8 animations and 23 interviews, with Staton directing, co-producing and writing the powerful narration for the film. This powerful film quickly won various awards and continues to be shown in festivals around the world and is now in cinema release. And joining us from Auckland, New Zealand, is Kim Staton. Welcome, Kim. Thanks for coming on our program.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Julian Assange. We've talked a lot about Julian Assange on this program since we've been on, and we've been on for a year. In a couple of words, how would you describe Julian Assange?
Just in a couple of words is tricky for someone that has achieved so much. And
well, is he a hero?
I admire greatly, but you could certainly just say a heroic, multi-award-winning journalist, peacekeeper, and a genius.
So why are they trying to smash him to pieces, do you think?
Well, because in a few short years from the founding of WikiLeaks in 2006 to 2010, when they finally got stuck into unraveling the war crimes and corruption and various dirty business of the United States, it just so quickly emerged that Assange and WikiLeaks had this incredible power to challenge the mainstream narrative, to take on, for the first time, really, this sense that, you know, we don't know really what's going on in the world, and there might be a whole nother story and a whole bunch of insights that we need to obtain. And that scared the daylights out of them. It was a major pain in the proverbial for someone to come along and speed up the dissemination of truth by protecting the anonymity of whistleblowers and making it more to make it safer and faster and easier for the public to get useful information.
Where was journalism when the heat started to come on Julian Assange then? Where were they?
Look, I think at that time, journalism, there was plenty of journalists with integrity, less than we have now due to the chilling effect or the journalistic ice age that's upon us ever since they started persecuting Assange. John Pilger was a fantastic example of that, who just sadly passed away on New Year's Eve. We were fortunate enough to interview him for the film, and possibly it was his last filmed interview, just by chance, was the one that we did for this film. I really admired his work for many years since watching his film Utopia about the Aboriginal people in West Arnhem Land, near the Yolngu people, I think it was. But anyway, the way he made that film was just so honest and searing. His journalism was, you know, one of the first insights for me before I actually looked into Assange was the Australian journalist John Pilger, the way that he bravely revealed the truth on many matters and a counter narrative to the mainstream.
Many of us wonder, because we're not Australians, but we're not that far away. Why there isn't more noise, and maybe there is, and it's just not being reported, coming from, well, everyday Australians, in defence of one of their own. And that goes right up through to the Prime Minister.
Yeah, well, look, it's a very different situation for politicians compared to everyday people, citizens. I think in regards to the citizens, it's just a lack of awareness. What I'm seeing is that with the response to this film has been extraordinary, the way that it's been taken up by cinemas all over Australia, New Zealand, and we're just about to release in the UK in a few days. So we already have 200 cinemas showing it, and it's really blown me away, the reception to the film, the way it's taken off. And what we're seeing is that people are really curious about this issue. They really want to know the real story. They're fed up with years and years of hearing this person, Assange, being brought up in the media, all these different opinions, the lies and the smear, and the debate around it, and all the confusion. People don't know what to make of it. And so they're quite willing to come and sit down to buy a cinema ticket, spend a couple of hours and get a different story on it. And I do find that people are really grateful to finally make sense of it for the first time, and very willing to, when they look at all the facts all laid out in the whole story, it's very damning. It's very revealing. The way that Julian is being treated is an obvious sign of torture, of his transgression of his basic human rights. It's wrong on a million different levels. So, you know, your average decent person is very, very willing to support Assange, and to when they finally get their head around this whole whistleblowing and classified information hoo-ha, then they, you know, they can be capable of looking past that, you know, that sort of smoke and mirrors effect of all of these terms that are applied to this situation, and realize that at the heart of it, this was a brilliant Aussie, compassionate, gentle intellectual, Julian Assange, who came along and wanted to bring truth to the world for the purpose of bringing about more justice and ending wars. It's very simple for people to understand at the end of the day. Whereas the politicians, what we've seen in Australian politics is that government after government and prime minister after prime minister have been completely subservient to the United States.
Why? Why though, Kim? Why?
Well, because, I mean, you know, that's a whole nother rabbit hole to go down to understand about, you know, to the degree to which the US owns Australia to a degree, and that's a whole long conversation.
Well, I guess when I said why, I kind of was a bit preloaded, because It is known that our Five Eyes have cooperated in spying on Americans as an outsourced resource to the American security, what do they call it, community or whatever. So no one wants that to unravel, do they?
Yeah, well, look.
They're in it like everyone else is really what I'm saying.
There's a strong alliance, and I'm sure there's a few positives, not many, about it. But also there is some kind of ownership that the US has over Australia and its assets, and so does England. And that's why I say, you know, it's a very long conversation, that one. But people can look deeper. They can read various books about that, about the relationship politically and financially, the way that various countries very much own a lot of the assets of Australia and therefore have a lot of influence. But you know, what we've seen with the prime ministers is that you know, Gillard was the first prime minister to begin the Australian persecution of Assange. Every other prime minister has followed suit and just followed their marching orders from the US. Albanese is the first one to sort of dance along the fence. He's a terrific dancer, trying to pacify the supporters with this sort of enough is enough stuff and quiet diplomacy that he claims to be doing. But
do you think he's doing any quiet diplomacy? This is show, isn't it? It's got to be.
No, I don't think he's done very much, but you know, it's been, he made these claims, and then it was a few months ago that some FOI requests revealed that basically there's been very few Very, very little communication between the Australian government and the US on this. And what has been done is basically along the lines of let them take him to the US, put him on trial, and when he's sentenced, when he receives that 175-year virtual death sentence, perhaps he can serve some of that time in Australia. And that's basically all they're willing to do. But Albanese will quite happily make it look like he's doing more. And that's just to pacify.
But he could die. This is the thing. People are saying that his health is so compromised, he could end up dying. How could a prime minister of a country let that happen to a citizen?
It's disgusting. And look, you know, what Albanese said in Parliament, which is a little clip of that is in the film, is that he said, I've said before, enough is enough. But in saying that, I don't have any sympathy for some of the actions of Assange, which was just such an immoral statement to make.
Well, for adhering to journalistic principles that a free democratic society is built on, that's all.
Yeah. And for being so brave to expose the war crimes of some of the nastiest people on the planet.
Yeah.
Who are our
allies, it turns out.
Yeah. But, you know, at the same time, I don't want to come across as, fully anti-Albanese and sort of too scathing because I think that somewhere in there he does wish that he could help Assange. I think he's torn. He's probably being threatened or coerced or bribed or whichever one it is. What I'd like to say to him, if he's ever listening to any of these interviews, is that, you know, just consider how you can be remembered by future generations if you're brave enough to just come out and be bold enough to say, this is an Australian citizen. Free this man today.
Well, couldn't he say? Alcus is off. Sorry, it's off until we get him back. It's off. We're not doing it.
Yeah, he could say that, and or he could just say, you know, this is our citizen. What on earth are you doing using a US law against an Aussie journalist?
Yeah, with charged with stuff that didn't even happen in the US.
Yeah. Assange wasn't even working in the US. And it's not espionage what he's doing. It's journalism. It's challenging the powers and revealing their crimes. He's not the criminal. He's the publisher of this evidence. So the whole thing is based on absurdities and all of this. All of this projection of criminals projecting onto others as if they are the criminals, and it's all about the narrative.
I recall, I think, who was the former head of the CIA, Trump's guy, security guy, name will come to me in a moment.
Pompeo.
I think he even publicly called for Assange's assassination, didn't he? Like, we need to take him out with a drone or something.
Yeah, just one of the many reasons why the whole extradition case should have been dropped early on, because, you know, there was evidence of a Yahoo News journalist went and interviewed, I think something like 24 ex-CIA or current CIA staffers, and they all basically substantiated that Mike Pompeo with Trump, under Trump, they were doing up sketches of how to assassinate Assange by either poisoning him or having some sort of standoff out on the street that was all set up in advance. So, you know, it's all disgusting behavior that is typical of an organization that is known for murdering anyone that challenges their self-assigned right to power.
Well, I got to say, any liking of Trump crashed and burned for me on Assange and Operation Warp Speed. There's no coming back from that. Anyway, what have you found? Anything new, anything that sort of blew you away that you sort of came upon in making this documentary? Was there anything?
Yeah. Look, I'll send you a link to watch it if you like, and you can have a private link to check it out, because there is some footage that was provided to us. you know, when we set out to start on the film, I did hope, I had it in my mind that maybe we would come across something very interesting that people hadn't seen before. And when we interviewed the editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks, Kristen Raffenson, in their London office, after the interview, he said, look, we've got this footage which has never been seen, and it's an interview with one of the child victims of the collateral murder incident, Syed Mutashar, who's 10 years old. And
was that the helicopter gunship attack in Iraq, was it?
Yeah. So Syed Mutashar and his younger sibling were coming home from school in a van with their dad, and they were the first to arrive at the scene of this terrible murder of civilians and journalists that happened on that street corner. So they're in the van as it drives up. They pull over, as any decent person would, to try to help a dying man that's crawling around in his own blood on the street. They pull over, they're trying to help him into the van, and in a clear, obvious war crime that no one can argue against, the Apache helicopter starts shooting into the van, raining bullets. The two kids only survive because their father throws his body over the top of them. He's killed in the incident. The kids are wounded. And so the interview is with that boy, and he's very emotional in the interview, and he holds up his shirt to show the wounds in his stomach from the bullets.
Wow. So
it's really harrowing to watch. And it actually, what that footage does is further substantiate the human impact of that incident. It really makes it real and shows how it affected that's just one of the people that it affected. And sadly, Syed Mutashar didn't live to see justice. He was killed some years later in a car bomb incident. So never saw justice, and none of the victims ever saw justice. The US would like that incident to just be swept under the carpet and forgotten about, just for it to fade away. And I'm very proud in this film that we can dredge it back out of the archives for the other 95% of people that have never seen it, and show it to them on a big screen with this extra footage, this never seen before interview, as well as this expert commentary from John Pilger, Tariq Ali, Dean Yates, and a few others, to really understand the significance of this footage, which forms the basis of the persecution of why they're going after Julian, is because this footage is embarrassing. It's an obvious war crime, and they covered it up and they never did anything about it.
Am I right in thinking that the leak of that footage and other information came from Chelsea Manning, did it?
Yeah, that's right. That was part of the Iraq war logs, which Chelsea Manning was working for the US Army. She was the one that provided it to WikiLeaks. The 18-count indictment that the US is using under the Espionage Act claims that there's a count of computer intrusion. They claim that Assange helped Manning hack into the US computers, but she has revealed and testified that she had access to it. She didn't need help to get in. She just could access it anytime she wanted. So that's another bogus claim.
She did, I think, prison time, but was pardoned, am I right, by Obama?
Well, not quite pardoned, but it was
released.
Was permitted. I can't remember the term, but it's not quite a pardon. It's
but you're out, right? You're out of jail.
Exactly. Yeah. So she's free, and she's the whistleblower, whereas Assange is the publisher. You would think he'd be free as well.
Well, that's where I was heading to. So I'm wondering if there's something else somewhere that and the reason I mention that, because I know there's Seth Rich, right? That's lurking. And also, I think in his last interview, maybe you've seen this, we were alerted to this by Candles for Assange, where he talks about the Internet of Things. And there's speculation that there's more than the footage that we've just been talking about, that there's something else that's, you know, can explain why they are going so hard on this guy when Chelsea Manning's out walking around.
Yeah, look, I guess it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is that Assange has so much ability to bring masses of truth to the world, and as he did with WikiLeaks, and if he ever gets free and is able to recover from improve his health and recover his health, and he got back to work, well, then we would have access to more truth as we need. Like, that's surely what the world needs.
But do you think that there might be something else that is lurking there somewhere?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure they have masses of data that's hiding away. And I've read bits and pieces on that there's, you know, a dead man's switch, and there's, you know, I'm sure they've got plenty of info that they haven't got out yet. You know, WikiLeaks is still operating, and but they do spend most of their time, money, resources on trying to get their founder free.
Have you had anything happen that's a little out of the usual for you after taking on this project and seeing it through? Are you on anyone's screen?
Not that I know of. You know, everyone asks me that, and it's a valid question. When I started this project, I did sort of fully prepare myself and expect to have some sort of, backlash or challenges to try to prevent the film from being finished. But nothing happened. You know, I warned our editors that we might get our computers hacked or something like that. Nothing happened at all. Even our social media up, and I don't think it's really been even shadow banned. And I think the reason for that is that documentaries usually just document a passage of time. They're usually a strict chronological sequence of events. That's the normal stock of a documentary. This documentary is different. We have a timeline in the first sort of 8 minutes of the film where we, for people that don't know the story, we bring them up to speed with a very efficient timeline presentation of the whole story. But that's over in the first 8 minutes. And then after that, we free ourselves up to go into deeper into the meaning of everything, and we can reveal all the ways that Assange has been persecuted, within chapters, and it gave us the chance to assemble something that's very impactful emotionally, and it's very shocking. And then also at the end, there's a whole chapter of that's meant to be inspiring, to inspire people into action, rather than, just documentaries often just end abruptly, and you just feel like you just sort of get up and go, oh, well, someone else will deal with that. But I didn't want that to happen. I wanted the film to be so impactful that people would cry and they would feel angry, and I have a whole range of emotions. And then in the last 10 minutes, we really have some powerful motivational messages, inspirational, philosophical stuff that hopefully will motivate them into action. And so the combination of all that is that people are coming in with no knowledge at all. They're feeling impacted and motivated as well. And then they're going and getting involved in the campaign, and they're doing something. Maybe his opponents didn't bank on that and didn't expect it. And so I think this film is something much more powerful than your average documentary, and has the ability to motivate people. It's too late. It's out there now. It's finished. It's done. It's licensed. Even footage from American TV shows is licensed. Joe Biden and so on making their statements, and then the film has been classified in various regions, and even that was a smooth process, and the classifications are quite mild, so they're not even going to scare off retirees and grandparents from coming along to see it. I mean, that's a huge portion of our audience is mature aged, which is great, so the film's out there and it's on the loose, and they can't really do anything about it, and I think it's only a matter of time before people in Australia, US, UK, New Zealand and whatever other countries we can manage to get it out to, they're really getting a huge wake-up call on this issue. And of course, Assange is only the canary in the coal mine of what's wrong with our so-called democracies.
What do you think his chances of beating the extradition, because we're still waiting to hear, right? And eventually overcoming this. Do you think there's a chance?
Yeah, if I didn't think there was a chance, I wouldn't have done all this work to make a film and with the aim to get him free. That's what the film is aiming to do. It wasn't just to document, but it's really aiming to add weight to the campaign for his freedom. I think it's very much within our capabilities of the majority, we being the majority, we being the people that should make decisions in the world is the majority. We should have the power. And if we're armed with knowledge, then hopefully we can unite and get this solved. You know, right now he's in a terrible situation where the application to appeal has been heard a few weeks ago in London. We're expecting an immediate decision from the judges, but typical of their sort of behavior, they draw everything out, drag it out as long as possible. So they haven't made that announcement yet. And the best sort of outcome, apart from his outright freedom, is that perhaps they allow that appeal and then he's stuck in solitary confinement in UK's worst prison, Belmarsh Prison, for another 6 months, which would be very unpleasant for him. But at least it would give us a chance to get this film out to potentially millions of people, as well as all the other activism and campaigning that's going on around the world. But if they want to get him over to the US quicker, it could be any day now that they'll announce they will reject the application for appeal, put him on a plane, and he'll be over there, you know, in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is a rigged court comprised of security staffers and their families. No whistleblowers ever won in that court. He won't get a fair trial. He'll be kept under special administrative measures. They call it SAMs, which is just basically a form of torture. And then he's up for this potential life sentence. But the most scary thing about this situation is that once he's in the US, they could upgrade the charges and give him the death sentence. He could be executed.
Boy, if they did that, crikey, I don't know what would happen. They don't need to keep him in the conditions they're keeping him. And obviously that is a vindictive move. It's got to be, right?
Yeah.
Which tells you who you're dealing with, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Look, let me tell you a little story about a publisher that I came across when I was researching the middle section of the film, which is a free speech history. Goes back 5,000 years through history to sort of show some of the figures throughout that 5,000 years that have contributed to our ability to speak freely, how we had to sort of win that back, that right that we once had. Back in the Stone Age, where you could say whatever you want and maybe someone just hits you over the head with a bone. 5,000 years, it's taken us to claw back some sort of free speech, and now it's being eroded over the last few decades. It's going downhill. That's what people need to know. But anyway, 400 years ago, a gentleman in London by the name of William Anderton was an underground printer, and he was printing little pamphlets calling for the return of the ousted kings. And when the government found out what he was doing, they took him to court and, you know, found him guilty of, I guess, an espionage type charge, took him to the town square, chopped him in half, and I guess they hung him first. And
hung, drawn and quartered, yeah. So
hung,
treason.
Drawn and quartered.
Treason.
I just explain that for people that don't know what hung, drawn, and quartered means.
I've been not eating breakfast right now.
And then they dragged his dead body down the road. And the reason they did that was because it was easier than having the taxes on the printers. They could just warn off whistleblowers.
Oh, right, yeah.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that the court that he was tried was the Old Bailey. It's the same court 400 years later. Julian Assange was tried at the Old Bailey. They used the same tactics. They rigged the jury. They ignored the evidence. And the only difference is that in our modern age, we've decided that cutting someone in half and hanging them is no longer acceptable. But the way that they are slowly executing Assange is by keeping him in solitary confinement 22 hours a day for now coming up to 5 years in April.
Wow.
Which is, that alone, not to mention all the stress of being defamed, being isolated from your family, not watching your kids grow up, not having any idea of when you're going to be free, arbitrary detainment that just carries on. You have no idea what your future is. You can't plan anything. All of these, the combination of all of this is designed so that he will slowly die. It's a slow motion execution. Make no mistake about that. And people need to realize that's what they are doing behind closed doors, is trying to kill him.
Well, that's why I tend to want to rage a bit against, your politicians, because how could that ever be acceptable?
Albanese doesn't get this. He needs to watch this film or read this fantastic
book.
Well,
if he doesn't get that, he doesn't get anything. He's not the man for the job. In fact, he shouldn't be in that job. He's the worst person for that job.
Well, none of these, politicians should be in their roles, what we currently have. They're all bent in some way, or they just subservient to their corporate sponsors and their various influences. They're all placed there. They're not really elected. The whole two-party system is very rigged. So, we've got big problems in our modern society. The Western world is, we've just got so many.
How do we get here, Kim? How the hell do we get here?
How did we get here?
It used to be so good not very long ago.
Yeah, I think I would have enjoyed living back in the 80s or something, 60s or something, a lot more than this day and age, with this encroaching sort of techno-fascism that's creeping in, rushing in. Assange knew all about that. He was warning all of us. And, back 15 years ago, he was saying, we are the last free generation.
Wow.
And he was talking about surveillance and censorship. There's, he was writing books about this stuff. So he was trying to warn people, and they've scapegoated him. And, they just try to prevent people from cottoning onto this and waking up to it. And that's why, people need to see a film like this to, at least on one issue, just get informed and, just one weekend or one day or night of the week, choose a documentary such as The Trustful rather than yet another fictional movie.
Marvel. It's interesting what you say, because we've had a few documentaries made here after we had a very staunch protest at Parliament over COVID, and it ended in a pretty messy way, and it was portrayed in a particular way, and you can imagine what that was like by the mainstream media. Okay, it's taken a year or two to catch up with the truth. But that's come out in two documentaries that have been very well viewed and received in the country 2 years on. I've been at a few of the screenings, and I relate to what you're saying. People say, we didn't know this. We had no idea. And as the truth was hitting them, they got angry, actually. But then I'm thinking, how can you be so bloody ignorant?
Well, yeah, look, everyone's on that path to... some people are on this path to knowledge and some sort of awakening, and we all have to start somewhere. So I don't fault anyone. I really celebrate people that come out and watch this film and say, I'm shocked by this, and I just think, great, you're on the course to having some awareness of how the world works. That's a great thing, and how they keep. They keep us all in the dark is really at the base of it is because of our 40-hour work week that, even though we have all this technological advancement, most people still have to work 40-plus hours a week, and we get home and we're just tired. And I get it why people just want to
put the news on.
Put the news on or watch some Netflix series and, just something to relax, because we're buggered. So, I get that. What people really need to do is just find a little space in their lives to start to explore some counter narratives, some independent news. That's what I've done since I was 18. I watched a documentary called Baraka, and you know, that really put me on a course to discovery and curiosity to find out more about how the world works. And you know, everyone needs to go on that journey of just starting to look into things and be willing to challenge our beliefs.
Okay, coming up against time, curious to know if you've heard anything, because I guess you know, talked to people who have had contact with Julian Assange in this time, family members perhaps. I don't know how much contact that they have, but I guess if you're in solitary for 22 hours a day, that's not much. Is he capable of withstanding this mentally? What do they say about that?
He's very mentally strong. He's having physical challenge, understandably, under these conditions. And, you know, psychological stress predisposes human body to cardiovascular issues. So it's right. No surprise that he had a stroke about a year ago. So his left eyelid droops, so he looks like he's winking. And he has multiple other health issues. And, you know, you can't really stay fit and healthy in the situation that he's in. But he does his best. And I've been told that he walks laps around the cell to try to keep fit. He reads books and tries to stay with a kind of as much positivity as possible in that situation. But you know, your mind would really you would really go through you know, different feelings throughout every day of positivity and pessimism, which would be understandable. But I think all of the support that he has and the letters that he gets, and, you know, people should write a letter to him. There's a website, writejulian.com, instructions of how to do that. All of those things can combine to keep his morale up. He's got a wonderful wife that's very strong for him and two gorgeous boys, and they visit him once or twice a week, and as well as his lawyers and family and other visitors. And and my understanding, although I haven't met him, is that he's staying strong and his mind is still intact. He's very sharp, despite all the challenges. So it's his body that is struggling.
So the movie is in cinemas now, and obviously in New Zealand, because you're in New Zealand, so people can look out for that. The Trustful, Julian Assange. Now, if people want to find out more or get in and even help you, Kim, can they do that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So our website is thetrustful.org. So you can go there and find your nearest screening if you're in Australia, New Zealand, or the UK. Just about to release in the UK, as I said, and we'll gradually get to other countries. So the ways to support is, number one is just come and get a ticket to a cinema and go and see it, and then tell your friends about it. If you think it was any good, you know, if you found it powerful and impactful, please talk about it and recommend it to your friends. And there's a GoFundMe page linked on the homepage of our website. And also for people that are in the position, we are looking for investors to help us advertise the film and get it out. You know, when we released the film back in 28th of December, we had no advertising budget, and we did get some massive turnouts just on word of mouth, which was amazing. And after about 6 weeks, we had some investors come on board to help us advertise, to push it further out to more people. And as a result of that, it's been incredibly exciting what we're currently doing. The attendance has gone way, way up. We've had last week something like 4,500 people came through the cinemas across Australia and New Zealand. We reached 1.5 million people with the trailer via Facebook ads. So we're looking for more investors that are willing to back the film and basically give it some sort of reach, commensurate with, you know, what a blockbuster film would have when they bring out this latest Superman movie or something. This is a real life Superman that stood up to the most powerful empire that's ever existed. And I think this story deserves to have that sort of same reach as a blockbuster movie. And so thanks to our investors, we're achieving that. And that's actually making it grow and grow. And now we have cinemas running it. One of the cinemas in Australia had 30 sessions already, and they're still going. So it's extraordinary. It's way surpassed my expectations of how it would be received. It just continues to grow, and we're really excited about releasing it in the UK and shortly, and it won't be long before we can get into the American cinemas as well.
That's going to be interesting. Getting into US cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
Take it right into the belly of the beast.
Exactly, yeah. I'm really looking forward to that, and I think we'll be surprised by the passion in America with this issue. You know, I think someone at Auckland screening last night commented the American, if I was American, I'd be embarrassed by this. And so.
Well, there is a disconnect, isn't there? It seems you sort of pick up. I mean, I was in America not too long ago, and a few conversations with people kind of made me realize that there's a disconnect between the industrial, military, political complex and the everyday people. There really is. It's an obvious one.
Really, one of the interesting interviews I did a few weeks ago was with an ex-military veteran of the US Army. And, you know, he's someone that, like Daniel Ellsberg, the legendary Pentagon Papers Vietnam War whistleblower, went on a journey of a change of heart, of being, instead of being sort of pro-US military, you know, go in and invade countries sort of thing, freedom and democracy. He realized peace was the way, and this fellow has gone through the same sort of.
Who are you talking about? Anyone that we might recognize? Any name?
I can't recall his name right now, but he did struggle a little bit with the footage, the collateral murder footage, the interview with the boy, and he sort of said, "Well, you know, it feels like propaganda watching that. You know, there's this sort of emotional cello music that comes in and out." And I said to him, if that's what it takes to get people to cry and to feel something and then be impelled to do something, then, you know, I decided to do it, because people have to feel something before they take action. And let's remember that this is a real crime that happened, and no justice was ever done. And, you know, when we had that discussion, I think he started to understand where I was coming from. And as I said, he's on this journey of change, which is such a courageous thing for someone to do, to completely change their worldview and their way of you know, relating to the world, and to get into more of a sense of wanting to bring about peace in the world instead of doing everything with, you know, bombs and guns.
An interesting point that you just his comments interest me, because you can really emotionally load something with music, and you can do it for good or you can do it for bad as well, can't you?
Yeah, well, look, we certainly were wary of that, conscious of that when making the film. And I've seen plenty of documentaries where it's just it feels very propagandish because of the constant music. And but the thing is, the film doesn't contain any speculative comments. It's all factual,
right?
And that's where no one can say it's propaganda. And, you know, as I say, just throwing it in a bit of music, we're very tasteful about where we put it, and it's only here and there. And I just think it's important for people to feel something, because, you know, this is a clear case of persecution, of oppression, of an individual, of a person who was courageous and has been scapegoated. And so there's just no option of being neutral on this situation. You know, people are on the fence, or they're on one side or the other.
Yeah.
The only people that against Assange is because they sell arms and they have a vested interest in the industry, the business of war. Or they're, you know, annoyed at him because he apparently stopped Hillary Clinton getting into power. You know, other than that, people just either know or they don't. And if they don't know and they watch the film and they get informed, and as I said, this is not a conspiracy film with all kinds of theories speculations. It's all factual, and there's only one side to it. There's only really one conclusion to come to, is that this individual has been vastly abused.
Yeah, I don't think you get some of the names that are associated with this. Something like Roger Waters, Susan Sarandon, Jill Stein, Stella Assange. It goes on. They wouldn't be having anything to do with you if it wasn't right. I'm picking.
Yeah, I made it clear to all of them that I was making a film 100% in support of Julian, for the reasons that I said, and the caliber of the interviewees in the film and the narrators, Susan Sarandon, Roger Waters, Tom Morello, MIA, that's just testament to the support that Julian has from all different places and all walks of life, and a lot of very successful, well-known and very articulate people and very clever people. I really think anyone with half a brain can wrap their head around which side of this issue they should be on.
Kim Staten, thanks for coming on our radio station and chatting with us about your documentary, which is The Trust Fall, Julian Assange. Really interesting. Wish you all the success with it.
Thank you very much for the coverage and for your interest and for the work you do and being brave enough to be a journalist that can support Assange and look into all of these important issues.
RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.